Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Oh,
there wasn't the same amount of goodwill in that one.
It's because you've lifted the curtain.
Would it help if we picked a word with a harsher first sound? Ciao sort of builds up. It's hard to sink against.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a lovely day. I've just watered the basil and the coriander plants. The euro is still existing for now, and I don't know. I just really don't know what's going on in the world. But in this tumult, there is an island of calm that we can rely on, upon which we can rely, and that's Linux Voice. This is the Linux Voice podcast, series 3, episode. What episode are we on now?
12.
Episode 12, can you believe it? I'm Andrew Gregory. Hello, listeners.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
Stay tuned, listeners. We will get past these technical issues very soon. I'm Mike Saunders.
Yes, and together we are the Linux Voice podcast team. We also produce a magazine called Linux Voice, which is about Linux and free software. And if you like the sound of that, go to shop.linuxvoice.com for more details. I'll pop up unsuspectedly at about halfway to tell you more about subliminal marketing messages.
It won't be unsuspectedly anymore.
Oh no. well, never mind. So still to come, we've got news, we've got discoveries of the week or fortnight, we've got a halfway reminder, we have Vocalise Your Neurons. Mike, do we have any neurons to vocalise?
Nope.
Okay. And we have the discovery of the month, of the week. What is it now? We have Voice of the Masses, don't we?
There's chaos.
There's so much stuff going on in the podcast. I can't. My tiny mind can't handle it. Still, at least I won 5 pints at the pub quiz last night. That's the main thing.
Do you ever need to
Did
buy
you drink
your own
them all
beer?
In a row?
We need to buy the initial beer, but then you just keep making it back.
Was that 5 points for you personally or as a team?
The team was me and Rob, so we've got 2.5 pints each. It's not enough. It's not enough to sustain us through the next pub quiz. It's like a Ponzi scheme. It's all going to come crashing down. Which brings us on to news.
The massive Ponzi scheme of news this fortnight is... Microsoft have become a gold sponsor of OpenBSD. That's not a Ponzi scheme, that's just news.
Is this from The Onion?
No.
I forgot to put in an Onion article.
Oh, yeah. That was a great idea.
Although, to be honest, a lot of these do sound like they could be Ponzi scheme. Onion articles this fortnight. No, we don't know exactly how much they've donated, but a gold sponsor's put in between $25,000 and $50,000, so a reasonable chunk of cash. They're the highest sponsor, although there are higher levels. There's Iridium and Platinum and whatnot, but no one actually sponsors at those levels. Google and Facebook are both silver sponsors. And this follows on from Microsoft's decision to include OpenSSH support in Windows. That's one of the many projects that fall under OpenBSD.
Yeah, and it's also worth remembering that the OpenBSD team does a lot of security research and finding and fixing bugs in other programs and software that run on OpenBSD as well. So, this is not just about helping OpenBSD, it is about helping these other projects, and their guys generally do lots of awesome security work.
Indeed, although that doesn't include things like Internet Explorer.
Well, maybe it does. I mean, it's BSD code, so it could be anywhere.
That's true.
It's BSD license, so it's in Microsoft's interest that BSD license code does well. They can take whatever they want from it and lock it up into any proprietary software. But cynicism aside, it's the OpenBSD project was in real financial trouble, I think, at the start of last year. Theo de Rat couldn't even afford to keep his electricity, you know, the electricity going to all these servers. So it's good news, even for a project that doesn't directly affect Linux. Indirectly, it affects free software a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that we hit a turning point about last year with all the sort of highly publicised security bugs, and everyone was like, wow, what do you expect if no one funds any of the security stuff? And everyone said, oh, we're going to fund the security stuff, and you just expected it all to go back to normal and no one funding the security stuff. But actually, it's starting to look like people are putting their money where their mouth is. Obviously Microsoft here, but also a lot of companies through the things like the Linux Foundation's core infrastructure project, which we had news on before, and all that sort of thing. So maybe we're on the verge of a more secure world, maybe.
I don't think it's a less cynical world, though, for what Microsoft's doing. Dr. Roy Shestovich, you know, the guy who does the tech rights. He wrote an interesting blog post about how this isn't a new dawn for Microsoft, how there isn't any change in its approach to free software. And he writes specifically about Microsoft pursuing Kyocera, who are still a large company, and they produce Android phones now. They used to produce printers. And Microsoft really just going after them for various patent infringements in their Android phones, so Linux basically. And he does make a very good point that behind the scenes, we don't know, but Microsoft already has many, many such agreements with other Android phone developers and producers such as Samsung, none of the details of which are published. And in fact, the agreement that they came to with Kyocera, where Kyocera obviously had to pay Microsoft a lot of money, cannot be published either. So it's Microsoft is still this patent stalker, and still I find it difficult to believe there's any kind of thawing in its attitude towards free software.
Well, it could be a case that the geeks inside the company are getting more Linux friendly, the bean counters and the legal department still see Linux and free software as this perennial threat.
Right, second up on our Ponzi scheme of news this fortnight is the Supreme Court of the United States has rejected...
Sorry.
That was them just now. That was the Supreme Court.
that was the very sound of them rejecting Google's appeal on the copyrightability of APIs. This is a long-running legal case between Google and Oracle, where Google re-implemented the Java APIs for Android completely separate to Oracle's version. Oracle shook a big stick and said, no, you can't do that. We can copyright our APIs. Not the actual code behind it, but the structure of the API call in Java. And Google said, oh, that's obviously ridiculous. You can't copyright APIs. We've been re-implementing stuff since the dawn of computing. It would be madness to copyright them now. And it's been through courts, and they've had one decision each, basically, and it went to the Supreme Court to make a final decision. And the Supreme Court basically said, we can't be bothered to make a final decision. We'll let the early one stand, which was that Oracle can copyright their APIs, but only because it's a big whopping one in Java, not just a little piddly one.
So what does this mean then for Android now?
It probably means more court cases, because there's an argument that Google were just trying the wrong tactic in saying the API wasn't copyrightable, when they should have been saying, okay, it is copyrighted, but we've got a fair use exemption, which means that even though it's copyrighted, we're going to re-implement it anyway, wave two fingers at you and go ahead as we've always done. So in the short term, it probably means nothing, but it could have implications for other projects that are seeking to re-implement APIs. Like Wine, maybe, for instance. And I believe it can cause particular problems if you change the APIs, because if you re-implement them under fair use, that's fine. But if you start changing things, that can cause problems as well. I should point out as well, this is only a US decision. In the EU, APIs aren't copyrightable, because in a rare moment of sense, the European Union said, no, that's obviously ridiculous. You can't copyright APIs.
I asked Simon Phipps about this at the end of last week. because Simon was working at Sun and part of the team responsible for their long-term project of open sourcing Java. And I asked him for his opinion. And he said he thinks that Google has... He doesn't know, but he wants to wait for it to go to the district court because he thinks that Google will have a strong or significant case with the fair use defense. So it might be too early to draw any big conclusions from it other than dealing with this kind of stuff at the Supreme Court level where people, I imagine, have a very shallow understanding of what they're actually talking about. It's so dangerous for such hugely impactful decisions.
The problem with the fair use defense is it still makes it legally tricky for other projects to implement them because it means that there is actually a court case to be heard.
Right, right.
If they just weren't copyrightable, you could just do whatever you want, off your pop, re-implement it as you wish. But with this, fair enough, Google can fight the legal case and do it. But if you're a small open source project, then you might think twice about re-implementing an API.
So let me get this straight. Oracle makes Oracle Unbreakable Linux. That's basically a Red Hat respin. It takes all this work from the open source community and makes its own product off it that's apparently quite popular for running the Oracle database. And then they get to throw a massive hissy fit when somebody re-implements some of their APIs.
Yes.
Okay.
Awesome news. Good summary there. That was like John Craven's news round.
It's actually even worse than that, because what Google do is they take, so what Oracle do is they take all Red Hat's work, add on some stuff that they then don't share with anyone, a few sort of kernel patching bits and pieces, and then release it as Unbreakable Linux.
Oh, if only Red Hat could sue Oracle. I mean, that wouldn't work for other projects based on other distros. But, you know, just to make a point out of this.
Maybe. You know how there's... you can have, like, bug bounties for people who find bugs, and you can do them for security patches. Maybe we could introduce a slap bounty. So the first person to go and slap Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, gets, like,
I wondered what you were going to say then. First person to assassinate. The first person, yeah. We should give the money to the second person.
That's a Roald Dahl short story, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah. It's Roald Dahl or Jeffrey Archer. I get this too mixed up. It'll come back to me. Never mind.
Pretty depressing, and it's but always depressing when Oracle are in the news. Why? You know, they're a significant Linux vendor. Poor old Sun. I wish Sun was still here.
So, our third item on our Ponzi scheme of news this fortnight is the first one to actually be related to Linux in any way. Jonathan Riddell has quit the Kubuntu Council. This is part of a long-running saga that we've reported on before, where the Ubuntu Community Council basically said they no longer saw his authority in the Kubuntu Council because they didn't like working with him. The Kubuntu Council said, we get to decide who's in our council. Go away, Community Council. And it's come down to Riddell actually ceding to the Ubuntu Community Council's decision and stepping down. This obviously isn't too pleasing for the Kubuntu Community Council. And there's some news sites are reporting that there's a chance of the Kubuntu ceasing to be, but this seems unlikely at this stage.
Am I right in thinking that Riddell wasn't being paid to do this?
He wasn't being paid by Canonical anymore. He was originally employed by Canonical, and then they decided they didn't want to financially support Kubuntu anymore, but Blue Systems stepped in and...
The Church of Blue Systems.
He now works for them, and they released their own distros as well, which include KDE-based, Ubuntu-based distros. So he was being paid to work on KDE on Ubuntu.
So is it just a case of he's completely sick of all this sugar storm and has just started walking away to have an actual life instead of dealing with constant flame wars?
Yeah, I mean, I had a look on his blog to see if there was anything, you know, if he had a take on it, but he just had pictures of him surfing.
So he is having a real life now instead of getting threats on the internet.
I can't say for sure whether or not he was surfing before this, but It's just like, sod this Kubuntu lark, I'm just going to go to the beach instead.
Wasn't there some, I haven't read too deeply into it, but wasn't there some implication that there'd been private communication between the community council and the Ubuntu people, and they'd kind of highlighted areas where they felt Riddell had that, where they were so displeased with him or whatever he's supposed to have done, but none of this is public, so we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of tricky situation because the Ubuntu Community Council have said, you know, it's a personal matter, it shouldn't be aired in public. And there is a reasonable case for that. You know, you wouldn't usually expect, you know, if a company had an issue with an employee, they wouldn't publish all that employee's personal emails. It would be, you know, their private matters that shouldn't be aired in public. And if this is private communication between Riddell and other people, then there is a reasonable case for saying it should be heard in public. But at the same time, obviously the community wants to know what's gone on and why this decision was reached. Was it a fair decision? We don't know. And I was going through sort of various news stories this morning to sort of find out exactly what was going on. And one of them said that the original release notes for the alpha version of Kubuntu 15.10 included the line, "The Kubuntu team are committed to releasing 15.10 in October. Updates, bug fixes and future releases are uncertain." When I went to check that, the line wasn't there, but it could well have been removed in the meantime, or it could have been made up by a journalist trying to get a fancy headline. I don't know.
That's kind of, mildly threatening, isn't it? I mean, if you installed Kubuntu, you're still going to get regular Ubuntu package updates from Canonical servers, but I guess that means they're not going to update the actual Kubuntu specific packages.
I've never known exactly where the line is drawn between the Kubuntu and the Ubuntu packages or with any of the distros, especially when the KDE, I believe, comes from Debian.
Yeah, but you have package groups like in Zubuntu. It's not just Ubuntu with XFC packages. You install the Zubuntu desktop package, which is a meta package and includes other stuff as well. Almost all the work is still done upstream, but there are some things specific to the distro.
Yeah. Let's have a look. We still have a few items on our Ponzi scheme of news. Hacking team has been hacked, in the most ironic sounding news story of the week. Hacking team is a sort of Italian gun for hire that just hack people for the highest bidder. They're known to work with all sorts of shady regimes, although they've long denied it, they no longer can. Some hackers got in there, got 400 gigabytes of data and uploaded it all to a BitTorrent server. And for the last sort of week or so, various interested journalists have been pouring through it to see what they can find. Amongst the discoveries are they sold spy software to a group that Human Rights Watch described as a death squad in Bangladesh.
Right.
they were running a spy program in Colombia for the DEA, the USA's Drugs Enforcement Agency. They were trying to sell software to the British police that they knew was illegal for the British police to use, and try and find ways to hide its true capabilities so they could sell it to them without arousing suspicion.
What were they then going to do? Use it to spy on the British police?
No, use it to spy on the British public.
Oh, right. Oh, right. The British police were looking into this for themselves.
Yeah, despite the fact that it was illegal, and I assume the Reaper. And various other sort of flagrant abuses of human rights. There was a presentation where they were outlining their abilities to spy on Human Rights Watch and Privacy International for various dictators. They're just a group of horrible people doing horrible things with technology for fairly horrible governments.
That's a good news round synopsis.
Yes.
And now it's time for Blue Peter.
So they've been hacked, they got their comeuppance, and all their dirty laundry is being aired in public at the moment.
So So are they going to shut down, or what have they issued a statement?
What they've said is, oh, look at these people who've released all our stuff. Now all the bad guys know what we do, and you've made the world a much more dangerous place.
Did they say, won't somebody please think of the children?
They may well have done said, won't someone think of the children? And because alongside all their sort of details, the stuff they were doing, included details of the vulnerabilities they were using. So, for example, there was a Flash vulnerability that's been patched in the last few days. It was released by them. There was an SE Linux thing. There was a presentation that said they had the ability to spy on Tor, but I don't think exact details of that's been released yet.
Yeah, the Flash vulnerability one wasn't so exciting because there's one of those every few hours, but...
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in there. As I say, there's 400 gigs, so I'm sure we'll keep finding about new stuff for a little while. It takes time to sift through it all.
So there were Linux-specific exploits that they were using?
Yeah, there was an SE Linux exploit.
It's fascinating. Now, who's the meta hacker group that hacked the hacker group?
It was one guy. It was the same guy who did the FinFisher hack a little while ago. FinFisher's some surveillance software that, again, is sold by a horrible company to horrible governments.
Right.
I've forgotten his name.
Right.
Yes. So moving swiftly on to our final item in our Ponzi scheme of news this fortnight. The BBC is releasing a computer for the first time in, well, I don't know, however old I am, about that long.
In Ben lifetimes, that's a new unit counter.
Yeah, in the length of time it took me to get from school to Linux Voice in about that long.
One Ben.
It's not really a computer. It's a microcontroller board which features Bluetooth, magnetic sensor, a motion sensor, two buttons, and a whole bunch of LEDs. It's got a Cortex M0 processor, which is a change from the prototype, which had an AVR processor. It takes 3 volts of power via 2 AA batteries or any other source of 3 volts you happen to have kicking around the place. It's got 3 GPIOs. It's got a whole bunch of GPIOs, but most of them are on little thin things that are hard to access. It's got 3 easily accessible ones, which is enough for things like SPI or I2C. So I suspect that will mean there'll be a load of add-on boards that use those, or you could manually hack it to most microcontroller add-ons via that.
So those GPIOs are along the edge connector, are they?
There's 5 sort of big circly connectors. Sort of put crocodile clips in. 2 are power, well, 1's power and one's ground.
Right, okay.
And then 3 are GPIOs. The weirdest thing of it all for me is the program environment. Microsoft have built this weird web-based thingy, what's it? I haven't had a chance to try yet.
Yeah.
I don't think it's publicly open, but there's some screenshots of it and it just looks weird.
Yeah.
So you write the code and then you upload it onto the flash onto the device or something.
Yeah. So it runs exactly like an Arduino in that way. You code it on a regular computer. They claim you can do it on a phone as well and upload it via the Bluetooth from your phone, but I don't know how well that will work.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people were expecting the Beeb originally to make something like the Raspberry Pi, but this is a very different type of machine, isn't it?
Yeah, this is confusing newspaper writers all over the world because no one seems to understand what a microcontroller is.
No, and also it's being sent to like millions of kids. I don't know if so you're like 11 and 12-year-olds in the UK are going to get one of these.
Yeah, the change in the announcement, change in the plan from the original announcement to now, because originally they said they were going to make a few million and give them away for free, and that was it. They were going to axe the project and it would disappear forever. But now they're saying that they're going to give a load away for free, but they're also going to sell them to whoever wants them.
Right.
And they've subtly missed out the whether or not they're limiting the number now.
Yeah,
in the latest releases, they're not saying that. So I suspect it's going to be an ongoing project rather than a single drop as was originally announced.
I think it's strange, and I feel uncomfortable about it. I feel uncomfortable about the fact that it isn't like Microsoft's involvement. Nothing wrong with that. And in fact, you know, a touch interface for programming these devices without a PC is a really good idea. But I just wish it had been done in an open foundation-like way.
Yeah, I mean, what would have been really good, I think, is if they'd taken the something like the Arduino bootloader.
Yeah.
And made, because the Arduino bootloader should run on the Cortex MO. There's Cortex versions of the Arduino. And just created a better programming environment or more friendly programming environment. And to be fair, that may be what they've done. It's possible that they have used an open standard. I just strongly suspect they haven't.
But also, you know, when there's so much other stuff that they could use as a foundation, stuff like the Raspberry Pi, you know, which is so close and so much more functional, it just feels like a missed opportunity to me.
Well, they're very great pains to point out that it's not a replacement for a Raspberry Pi, it's a complementary product.
I know, but I mean, in terms of cost, I can't imagine it's going to be that much cheaper, and yet with a Raspberry Pi, you get a whole PC.
It's true. I mean, sort of looking at the layout and the bill of material, it's 5 centimeters by 4 centimeters, as I say, Cortex M0 processor, bunch of LEDs. I'd expect it'd probably be in the sort of £10 to £15 range, I reckon. So yeah, cheaper than a Raspberry Pi. I can see their argument for it. I mean, there's stuff like if they can get it to work with a phone so you can upload it straight from there, you can do it straight from a web-based environment on more or less any computer, just plug in the USB drive, go to the website without installing any software. If it works like that, that is actually...
Yeah, but that's exactly something they could have worked with the Raspberry Pi Foundation to produce. You know, even like a Model A or a Compute with a Bluetooth module on it and some low power. I mean, there was a battery adapter actually on the original micro bit that's gone, you know.
Yeah, the suggestions that that's because the battery on it could have been a choking hazard for small children.
Right, okay. But what I mean is something that kind of broaden and build upon what the Raspberry Pi Foundation has already done and tried to do and still maintain whatever it is the BBC and Microsoft and their other partners are trying to achieve, rather than create what I see as like almost a separate, almost proprietary ecosystem for schools, which is just counterproductive.
I mean, the board itself is completely open. The actual designs will be open sourced. So we're still, you know, obviously there's question marks about the software stack, but the hardware is open. And I don't know, I do see it being as a complementary device to the Raspberry Pi rather than as a...
Yeah, okay.
A separate.
And I suppose in terms of costs, the amount that schools spent on IT provision is, you know, humongous in comparison to this. That's
it's
a much
true,
bigger battle.
Especially as these are being given by the BBC.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I mean, by far and away, the biggest cost here is training teachers into the new IT curriculum. I mean, the cost of doing that well dwarfs the cost of hardware.
Yeah, yeah.
And if this helps out, if this, you know, this brings in new partners, this is a big initiative by what is fundamentally a media company or media organisation.
Or if it means schools end up buying hundreds of Microsoft Surface tablets just to be able to program these things. That's what
this is. Find the programming solution for those schools that bought iPads.
Yeah.
So the one thing we haven't mentioned is the programming languages that it can take. There's one by Microsoft called MS Touch Develop, which I haven't seen. I don't know what it's like. But you can also use JavaScript, Python, C++, or Blocks, which is a sort of Scratch-like drag-and-drop language. So quite a few programming options. Don't know how well they work yet.
I have to try and get hold of one and give it a proper kind of test when we understand more about the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, the crucial part will be how well the software works.
Yeah, and that you don't need Microsoft software to be able to program it.
Yeah, if that web interface only runs in
yeah,
in Internet Explorer, install this ActiveX component. Does ActiveX still exist? I don't know.
It was replaced by that great successful project Silverlight.
Ah. Anyway, that's all the news.
Thank you for the news, Ben. So it's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. Shall I? I didn't ask the IRC channel until we started news, but everybody joked on the IRC channel that gave them an hour, and they're not far off. there's not too much. HegX64 says, not Linuxy, but there's a clock that's powered entirely by variations in atmospheric pressure. The clock is still running despite never having been manually wound since its construction in 1864. I think I remember seeing this story years ago. Is it in a university somewhere? I'm just going to click on the link. It's called the Beverly Clock, a clock situated in the third floor lift foyer of the Department of Physics at the University of Otago in New Zealand.
So, but when you say powered by the atmospheric pressure, that doesn't mean it gets its timing from it, like day and night variations or anything like that. It just means it gets the energy from the changing pressure. Is that right?
I'm assuming it gets the energy from the change in pressure. I'm just quickly skimming through the paragraph on Wikipedia to see if that means that somebody has to make the time. Surely someone has to set the time on it.
Has to put it forward an hour every year.
Unless it just...
Every spring.
So apparently over the course of a day...
Or it could just be perpetually wrong.
There's enough pressure to raise a 1 pound weight by 1 inch, which drives the clock mechanism. Twisted Lucidity, reliable for finds. F-dupes, not really a find for me, but seems to be one for others. It's a super easy way to do deduplication from the terminal. I'm going to have to try that because I often need a deduplication tool, just something simple that isn't like a contrived command that I end up constructing for photos and such. I'd love a tool. There are some tools, actually, when you have audio recordings at different bit rates and you want to keep just the higher one, or you want photos that are at different resolutions but you want to keep the higher resolution photo, and they require some comparison. I wish there was a good tool to do that. So they're the finds from IRC. Does anyone else want to share their find?
Yes, I've got some finds.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So first is the logo of Human Rights First, which is an organisation that apparently promotes American ideals and universal values.
First.
I'm not sure why human rights are particularly...
Before anything American. Else.
But the logo... is suspiciously similar to that of Ubuntu. You know, the circle that's in three bits. Oh. That you look at it from the top down, it looks like three people having a group hug. Human Rights First logo just is exactly the same, but it's four people having a group hug. It's even the same colours. It's amazing.
Hmm. Oh, yes, you're right.
So, I don't know. I don't know who got there first.
That's a good point. 1978, the Human Rights First was founded.
Right. And presumably they didn't have their logo.
No.
Until they saw Ubuntu and thought they'd copy off of their awesome designs. And discovery number two is a page from a 1967 Cosmopolitan, which has been knocking about on Hacker News for a bit, and that is about, you know, women, there's this thing called computers. And apparently in 1967, a senior systems analyst could earn up to $20,000 a year, which is a bit depressing for me now. But, you know, never mind. But there's a quote in there from about how women are good at computing and naturally have an aptitude for it. There's a quote there from Grace Hopper who says, it's just like planning a dinner. You have to plan ahead and schedule everything so it's ready when you need it. Programming requires patience and the ability to handle detail. Women are naturals at computer programming. thought it's just like planning a dinner. Wow. Let's put it in terms that you women can understand. Oh, great stuff. Anyway, that's it. Those are my two finds or discoveries, if you want.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Anyone else want to share theirs? I've thought of one where I couldn't remember what I told. I told the guys that I couldn't think of one at the beginning, but I've actually remembered one that I found, which is pretty neat.
I have a couple.
Go for it, Ben.
The first one, neither of these are mine. They're both wildly stolen. The first one comes from at the Falcon on Twitter, who not only gave me the find, he tweeted me last night to remind me to remember the find, which I had forgotten. So thanks, the Falcon. And it's related to what we were talking about last week about getting to special characters when you need
them.
Oh, yeah. And it's a website, copypastecharacter.com. And it's just got a huge selection of Unicode in various things, and you just obviously copy and paste it into your work.
Excellent, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and just a reminder that in the UK you can register children's names with Unicode characters. So this could be
wow.
Yeah. So if you want to go and register smiley face, thumbs up, the third
aircraft.
You can do that with the help of copypastecharacter.com. My second one is stolen from Reddit this morning, and that's it's a couple of options for the make directory command mkdir. And the first one is the p flag, and with hyphen p, it makes the full path. So you can't, if you want to create a series of directories, one inside the other, you can use dash p and make them all in one go. The second thing is it can include curly braces expansion. What is the word for a curly brace?
Are they just braces? I'm sure there's some technical term, isn't there?
Yeah. I never know how to say it when I'm trying to talk about code.
I don't know.
But anyway,
curly brace.
So, yeah, is it just brace?
No, I don't know. It could be.
Anyway, these curly bracket things. So you can include multiple options. So if you need to create a full directory tree with like multiple directories at each level, you can do it by using the curly braces and they'll expand inside it.
Right.
So for example, if you wanted to create two directories, you could do curly brace, directory one, comma, directory two, close curly brace, and it would create both of them. But you could sort of expand that up by using the dash P option to create many levels of directories with everything you want inside them with one make directory command.
That's pretty cool. Good, yeah.
A real practical find for once.
Okay, well, my find came about through writing a tutorial for the last issue of Linux Voice, and it's free OTP. So it's this has been around for a while, and I suppose I've been late. I've been turning on two-factor authentication for as many of my accounts as I can. And the most people, there's a couple of standards that are used, and most people used Google's authenticator as the secondary authentication. So let me give you an example. If you're logging into your Google account and you want more than just a password, there is an app or a program that you can use that will generate a key that you can enter in as a secondary form of authentication. And for a long time, this project, Google Authenticator, was an open source project. Google created and then open sourced it. And then Google, in its infinite wisdom and in its constant push to make more and more of its software now proprietary, stopped developing it open source. But the project itself has continued, and it's called FreeOTP, and it's hosted by Red Hat. So that you get security patches, and there's an app for Android, and there's various implementations for different systems. So you can use it at Google, but you can also use it in an awful lot of other websites and on Linux. And so the tutorial that I wrote uses FreeOTP to add a second factor authentication to SSH prompts, and it's easy to do thanks to PAN, which is like the pluggable authentication module system in Linux. You can add these things, and you can even just log in by purely running this app or running whatever it is on your phone and typing in the code that it produces. It's a neat solution, because what happens is there's basically a public and a private key, and the private key is used to hash a timetable that both the client and the server knows to generate a key that it knows that it's been generated from the same private key. But that's all far too complicated. You don't need to know any of that. All you need to do is press a button, type in the six-digit numeric code onto your screen, and you get in. You don't have to remember any passwords. And because it's PAM, you can use it for logging in. You could use it for SSH and almost anything else that uses authentication in Linux, and on your own websites and on lots of other services as well. And because it's based on the open protocols, you can use it for lots of other places that also maybe have their own proprietary authentication app, which you may not trust. But because FreeOTP is an open source project, you can install it through FDroid and run it. That's my find.
That sounds awesome.
I have terrible trouble with SSH in particular. I have the automatic login set up with the private public keys. But this just, when I don't have to bother with that, it's good.
So this the project has both the Android app and the server side code to authenticate it.
Yeah, it's all open source. Yeah, the code to Google Authenticator is still called Google Authenticator as it was curated by Google, and it's open source. That's just been patched. The client has been updated and forked into FreeOTP, but there's also FreeOTP on the server as well. They're both equivalent because they run the same server protocols.
Is the Android app compatible with both? So can you use the proprietary Google Authenticator app and vice versa?
Yeah, you could. Yes, you could. I'm not sure about. I haven't tried the Google app, but you can use the FreeOTP app on your phone to log into Google using its proprietary server software. It still adheres to the protocol.
Okay.
So you can, even if you're using, I think you can do it with Facebook and Amazon and other sites that offer the same kind of secondary factor authentication through the same protocols, you can use this FreeOTP app on your phone.
Okay.
It's like the equivalent of those keys you sometimes use to log into banking. Maybe banks do it as well. But I really like the way that the key generation and all that stuff is open source. So that's my find.
Awesome. I had a couple sent to me. Woody told me about TLP. He says it brings you the benefits of advanced power management for Linux without the need to understand every technical detail. I think I set this up myself when I installed Zubuntu on this laptop. And you just run a couple of commands and then you get better battery life, basically. I think a lot of distros might include it as standard, but it's worth looking up. Phelan Whiteley sent me a link to a fascinating article on the New Scientist website called .-dis, The Gentleman Hackers 1903 Lulz. And basically, it talks about in London in 1903, there was a demonstration of wireless telegraph in a lecture theatre. There was a guy doing a demonstration there who was receiving signals from Cornwall, where the famous radio engineer Marconi was broadcasting them. So everybody's waiting for these signals to come in and a Morse code machine to start tapping them out. But somebody in the room managed to hack into this and made the Morse code machine send this message: "There was a young fellow of Italy who diddled the public quite prettily." It must be like the earliest ever electronic trolling, like 112 years ago.
Ye oldie 4chan.
Ye oldie 4chan, exactly. Yeah. And then I found something, maybe other people know about this, or maybe some people don't find it so fascinating, but it turns out that in April this year, there was the first visible light sighting of an exoplanet. An exoplanet being a planet that goes around another star. We've been seeing a big uptick in discovery of exoplanets in recent years. They used to only be found indirectly through, like, you watch how a star wobbles or other weird, crazy
the amount of light.
Stuff
that I don't yeah, really... when they were, the star was occluded yeah. by the planets moving in front of it.
Yeah, and all sorts of quite, you know, fascinating and funky methods for doing it that a lot of them I don't understand. But April, for the first time in the visible light spectrum, they saw the light being reflected off another planet
Wow.
From its own star. So actually seeing to some extent what it looks like. I mean, you still can't get any details.
Well, you should be able to get some kind of chemical analysis of a spectrography of the light's reflection, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
Are we completely sure this is another planet, not like a Death Star firing away at something?
I guess we'll find out pretty soon. But I saw a great article a couple of years ago about one way we could potentially find if there's life on other planets in our lifetime is by building a big telescope in space that looks for exoplanets, but has a coronagraph like several thousand or tens of thousands of kilometers away to block out the light from the star. Because that's the big problem, obviously. The star emits a trillion times more light than an individual planet. But with a very carefully positioned coronagraph, don't know how you pronounce it, but very far away, you should be able to align the telescope and that, and then possibly, potentially, get enough detail on a planet to see if it's like green at certain times of the year, and then it changes colour, it goes white. We might be able to tell if there's organic activity happening on another planet in our lifetimes.
Wow.
So this one that's been found, the first one, is it just chance it was found, or have we got better telescopes now? Are we looking harder?
I don't know. I mean, the methods for detecting planets is always improving. I believe this visible light sighting of an exoplanet it had been spotted before, maybe through infrared or indirectly.
I guess it's huge. It must be just like a huge gas giant like Jupiter. You know.
Yeah, they say it's one of those, what they call them, hot gas giants. So it's like a Jupiter that's orbiting very close to a star, something we don't really have in our solar system. But, you know, this is early days. The technology is improving, and maybe one day we'll be able to see more sort of Earth-like planets.
I was just going to say, it's related. There was a discussion that came up last week about what year does the Voyager spacecraft, you know, launched in the 70s, see on Earth when it looks back at Earth? And everyone was really disappointed that it's only 18 hours behind. It'll see Earth from 18 hours ago. on the 1st of January, you know, it'll still see 2015 when it's 2016.
Yeah, people always talk about the Voyager craft because they're doing something like 30 kilometers a second. And it's like, wow, they're going to go and see other stars. But it's going to take about 40,000 years to get to Proxima Centauri, even if it's going in that direction. Space is big, very big.
Being 18 hours ahead isn't really all that impressive when, you know, Australians are already doing that, already living the dream.
True.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Are Australians further away than the Voyager spacecraft?
If Australians got a telescope and started looking at England, we'd put a big mirror in the on the moon.
There are mirrors on the moon, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, there are, for firing lasers back, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and retro reflectors, not mirrors. But...
Okay, and that's our finds of the fortnight. Oh, 50 minutes.
Now that we're the best part of an hour into the podcast, it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, we don't have any neurons to vocalise. Repeat, no neurons to vocalise, which brings us straight on to Voice of the Masses. But before then, a quick reminder that if you like this ramshackle collection of bletherings, you can buy a version on paper or on EPUB or on PDF. And that's called Linux Voice, and that's in some shops, excuse me. So Sainsbury's, Morrison's, I think, Asda, some Tesco's, WH Smith in the UK, and around the world, your friendly local neighbourhood newsagent, and also from shop.linuxvoice.com, where you can buy subscriptions. So, Voice of the Masses, Firefox, what's it all about? What is it all about? I'll tell you what it is all about, actually. It makes my laptop run really hot whenever I open up Firefox. And that could be because I dropped it. I might have bashed where the fan sits, and so it just gets really, really...
Is there a dent in the aluminium case?
There are a couple of dents, yeah. And the screen's a bit bashed up at this top corner. We were trying to work out what rate our assets are depreciating yesterday. I think this particular asset has depreciated quite a bit. But no, that's... yeah, so Firefox then. Why does it make... why does it use so many resources? It's been a topsy-turvy few years for Firefox. Competition from Chrome, there's a new plan for the project, they've adopted Adobe's DRM module, boo! Interface redesigns, integration of services like Pocket. Firefox seems to just do it all rather than be the simple, you know, streamlined web browser that it was at its inception. So we want to know, what does Firefox need to do in order to maintain its lead? Does it have a lead? That seems a bit of a leading question, Your Honour, my lud, my learned friends. Does Firefox have a lead? No. Does Firefox need to be replaced by a new lightweight browser written from the ground up? Has Firefox merely turned into a clone of Chrome? What does it need? Let us know your thoughts. So let's kick off with Sam, who says it needs lower idle CPU usage and hence less battery drain. If Firefox is not focused, it should basically use no CPU. Currently, some background tab can be running some heavy JavaScript or animation, and there's not even any way to figure out which one. It used to be worse in the days of having a Flash installed, but it's still a problem now. And Mike Aden says, stop bloating it with tons of features that anyone will barely ever use just for the sake of getting out another release. Firefox doesn't need to change. It doesn't need to compete with Google. They just need to forget about competing for market share and just focus on being stable and supporting open standards. Burgess Meredith says, I use Firefox exclusively. I'd like to see Firefox go to a release model similar to Ubuntu. Let them keep their whirlwind release schedule if they want to. This is what Mike was saying about adding features just to get a new release out, just to justify a new release. But give us an LTS with real support. Their current extended
that
releases.
Exists, does so, it? Doesn't it?
Their current, yeah, is this the extended releases thing?
Yeah, there is such a thing in the Firefox world.
Right, so Burgess Meredith goes on to say, the current extended releases merely guarantees security fixes. I want an LTS that will fix all the freaking bugs and keep fixing them until the end of support is reached. Preferably this will be 18 months or more.
Okay, fair enough then, yeah. I mean, Firefox is due to get this, was it electrolysis update, whereby each tab will be a separate process. So one web page that's causing havoc with JavaScript or a plugin or whatever, it shouldn't impact the rest of the browser. At the moment, a single tab can slow down the whole thing. And you were mentioning offline, Andrew, that you were having problems with Firefox on your machine.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is a performance issue they really need to sort out.
But does that mean that if you have, let's say, four poorly behaving tabs open, you can take out your entire CPU rather than just one core as you can at the moment?
Quite possibly so, yeah. You know, I think it's a step in the right direction.
Hasn't Chrome had that for a while?
Yeah.
Well, with each tab running independently?
Yeah, because you can get a task manager up in Chrome, and it also has some weird statistics about like how many goats are sent into space every second or something.
Presumably that's no.
Zero, yeah. Right. Back to the masses. Hacker says Firefox needs to stop putting proprietary garbage in their browser. This being a reference to the Adobe DRM module. What do we think to that? Again, that's a leading question because I just booed. Boo. Boo DRM.
Well, I refuse to accept your leading question. And I say, I'm probably a lone voice here, but I actually think it's a good thing. Simply because that Firefox is losing market share and people want proprietary media. You know, you can bark on all you want about how they shouldn't. The fact is that they do. And things like Netflix are really important to a huge proportion of the web browsing public. And all you do is if you refuse to accept it, is you lose market share and become irrelevant by accepting it, even though we know it's a bad thing, but accepting it, you can at least stay relevant and push for open web reforms in other areas. You know, you can stay true to the cause, but it matters not if no one uses your software and everyone uses proprietary stuff anyway. Hang on, there's a knock at the door.
Uh-oh.
Ben has been arrested, listeners, operating that Tor exit node.
He's been arrested. Those Colombians.
They're not going to tell him what he's been arrested for. just going to tell him he's been arrested. And you can carry on with your life.
I've just got my cash payment from Adobe.
In Bitcoin.
Yeah, you can't prove a thing.
But we have had this discussion, and you know, I disagree. In general, I think it's impossible for Firefox to keep its share of the market. I don't think it's ever going to be as big as competing products from even Microsoft or especially Chrome. And I think Firefox and the Mozilla Foundation need to stick to one thing, and they need to have a single reason to exist. And I think that is to promote and ensure the compliance to web standards. It would be wonderful, for example, if Firefox or a browser like it could become the W3C standard browser that other browsers need to, you know, adhere to or to promote and be the flagship bearer for open standards. And I think it has become far too big and bloated and CPU heavy, and it needs to get back to basics. Having used, you know, Qt browser for the last couple of weeks, I can see that actually for most of my browsing, I want something that's fast and operable and efficient. Sometimes I want something more, but then I could load a Netflix app if I wanted to do that.
But when you say that it doesn't have to sort of focus, aim for the mainstream market, and it won't do that, what sort of market share are you seeing it dropping down to? 1% less?
Well, I think it's the same principle as Linux and open source in general. I don't think we'd accept all kinds of compromises in terms of proprietary software being bound to the kernel or shipped with Linux. You know, that you have to take a stand, and for me that does come with the inclusion of DRM or making it easy.
Hang on, we accept a huge amount of proprietary software.
Yeah, we do.
With Linux.
Yeah, we do. But you've got to, that's the choice that the user makes. I don't think that's the choice that the Mozilla Foundation should be making.
And actually, I think there's relatively little difference between what Firefox have done and what the kernel's done. All they've done is put in the hooks that enable a proprietary DRM service to be enabled, which is exactly the same as what the kernel's got to allow proprietary kernel modules to be enabled for graphics cards and whatnot. You can still, as a user, choose not to use it. If you wish, you can turn this off. You can say, no, I don't want to watch proprietary media. I'll stick with the free stuff. It just gives you the option of doing it if you wish to.
It's not just the effect that it has on the standard, on creating the what has become the HTML5 standard for video streaming that I thought was dangerous. But it's not just that. I don't like the way that the Mozilla Foundation is starting to look through your browsing history to be able to look at feeding you ads through the new window launchers and things like that. I don't like. I don't want to say I don't like it, because they do great things, and it may well be the right way forward, but it's just not the direction that I'd like to see the Mozilla Foundation take, which would be a much more standards-driven, much more compliance-driven future to make. And I think it would remain relevant. I think a lot of us would still use Firefox purely for that reason. It gives it a reason. At the moment, I'm much more likely to choose Chrome because it would play Netflix better than a compromised version of Firefox.
Yeah, me personally, I'd like to see Firefox as a standard-bearing web browser out there. Chrome is a pretty good web browser, but there are issues to do with the amount of data it sends back to Google and corporate control. You know, Microsoft's getting better with its browsers as well. But yeah, for me, Firefox, while the DRM thing is optional, fair enough, but bundling things like the Pocket integration stuff, you know, and trying to do all these deals with advertisers, it just sort of takes a bit of the niceness and the innocence away from the browser.
So what is Pocket?
It's something where you can save bookmarks and for websites. Something, if you see something, you can say, oh, I want to go and read that later. But I believe it's a proprietary service, isn't it?
Right.
So,
yeah. Basically, what it gives you is a little button on your web browser, and you click it and say add to Pocket. And what it'll do is it'll push it to your mobile phone and download everything. So if you're sat on the train without internet connection, you can then open it on your phone and still read it.
Hmm. But that was just pushed into the browser, whereas a lot of people said that would be much better as an optional extension. If Firefox just is a lean, clean, fast browser that doesn't have all this advertising and tracking and DRM immediately built in, but purely optional, then that would be better.
Yeah, I think Firefox also by default is ugly. I think the add-on system is really ugly as well, and I think maybe these are the more important, the terms of usability and security. I think that's what the focus should be for the Mozilla Foundation, and I do think it needs to be. It's got to the stage where we were with Netscape, and the emergence of Phoenix and Firefox in the beginning. We're almost at that stage.
Back to the masses. Back to the question of DRM. Ray Woods says that Firefox needs to become more efficient. Not everyone has the most speediest of computers. And also, it needs to become a DRM-free area. If no one enables digital restriction management, the users of it will cease to sell their wares. If I can loan a book to a friend, I should be able to do the same with its electronic equivalent. John Brown, where Firefox really lags behind his area of video support. Video is more important to many browser users than it has ever been, hence the EME DRM support making it into Firefox. And yes, and Nate says, for all the backlash and hate the project has been getting in the past few months over the addition of Pocket integration and enabling of DRM playback, I think they're still a shining beacon of a project and have done wonderful things for the FOSS world. Yeah. And finally, Woody, it makes me sad that the movie industry is forcing DRM into our browsers. Maybe one day they will realise that having content easily accessible is the key to reducing piracy. Yar.
But they haven't. It's almost like that battle has been lost, and I don't really understand it. There's so very little evidence to show that not having DRM is going to affect your business. And yet they carry on headlong into all these decisions.
Well, yeah, the media manufacturers are always going to demand it, aren't they? They don't think about this, how effective it is or not. There are bosses at the top of these companies who say, protect. Yeah.
That's a good excuse to mention that our PDFs, when you buy a subscription for Linux Voice, you get access to all of our back issues, DRM-free. So you can lend it to a friend and you can have it on more than one device. And
then they become Creative Commons as well after 9 months.
And it's just not a big deal because, it's not like there's one person, buying one subscription and then copying it for thousands of people around the world. Because that's who would be bothered to do that?
I mean, but Firefox, there's always a trade-off between performance and functionality. Somebody said the Mozilla team should make it the fastest browser possible. Well, yeah, I mean, Dillo is probably way, way faster than Firefox at rendering certain pages, but it does very little. We have to accept it's handling a lot of JavaScript and a lot of complications. So, yeah, they could improve performance, but modern websites are just so... They're in massive applications running on your computer in an interpreted language. They're going to take up CPU.
I mean, I think we have to take our hats off to Mozilla on one aspect of performance, and that is they've done a fantastic job of getting the JavaScript performance up to scratch recently. About 5 or 6 years ago, it was terrible. When Chrome sort of came to prominence, it was because it just ran so much faster than Firefox on JavaScript-heavy sites. That's no longer the case. And in fact, Firefox has probably overtaken Chrome now, and it's probably the fastest JavaScript engine. And they're doing a lot of sort of work on JavaScript and the way it's sort of run and implement things like ASM.js and its successors. And I think they're doing a lot of stuff to make performance really good in JavaScript-heavy interactive sites. And that probably does have impacts on memory footprints and stuff like that in areas where it's not necessarily necessary.
Yeah, good work. Good use of necessary. time is ticking on, so let's wrap this up with three final comments from the masses. Kevin O'Brien says, Firefox is the only major browser that is not corporate, so it can concentrate on security and privacy for users. Do that and keep it lean, and I will keep using it forever. Cole Mack says, add sharks with frickin' lasers. And finally, I want to give the last word from the masses to Toby, because I agree with him or her. Firefox should focus on its core, having a quick and lightweight rendering. Firefox should focus on its core, having a quick and lightweight rendering engine that makes browsing a fast and joyful experience. It should have less rather than more features, but allow extra features to be added by extensions. And Mozilla needs to remain our spokesperson and our last hope for the open web and open standards. Chrome is nice and fast, but it's open only to the extent that it suits Google's business interests. Mozilla should stand above these things. I think that's spot on. I like the idea that there's a champion out there fighting for internet neutrality and web standards.
The Android version's great. I prefer it, user interface-wise and everything. It's really good. So, is that it for this podcast?
I think we have to bid a teary farewell, yes.
But it's only Bon Voyage, isn't it? It's not goodbye. It's true. It's whatever the other thing is.
We'll meet again. Au
revoir. See you later. Yeah.
Someday. Auf Wiedersehen.
Bye.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye.